Hey everybody, and welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dakhil, and today my guest is Jeff Zilgit from USA Today. He's also on the USA Today podcast, NBA to Z. He's the co-host with Sam Amick. We're going to get into the Cavs, we're going to talk about Toronto, we're going to talk about really the Eastern Conference today. So buckle up and get ready. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm well, Mo. Thanks for asking. Hope you're doing well today as well.
I'm doing well. Looks like it's going to be a bit overcast in L.A. I know everybody else has snow, but for me, if I get overcast in L.A., I'm a little unhappy, but I think I'll survive.
So I'm overcast, but with warm weather, so I'm really happy.
There you go. Perfect. At least we're not in that snow. Like, I think it's like Minnesota's getting hit with snow right now, or I know New York's freezing.
Yep, and my dad, who lives in Michigan, I talked to him this morning. He said he was looking out the window, and he's got snow, too. So
there we go. So, yes. If we get snow in LA, it's going to be just everybody would freak out. I don't know if I could handle it. So, one thing I want to talk about before we get into basketball is, and this is really important, and I'm not sure how many people know this, and you've been very open about it, but you are going through colon cancer that has kind of attacked the liver, if I'm correct.
Yeah, you got it, Mo. Yep.
Perfect. I did my homework, which is rare. I didn't do it when I was in school, but I do it now. But I kind of want to talk a little bit about it and kind of what you're going through.
Sure.
So first off, kind of give us the update of your condition and let's go from there.
Yeah. So as it stands, as we talk today, I have one tumor, or as sometimes the doctors call it, a lesion, but it's essentially a cancerous mass. I have one on my liver, and then I have another one, and Mo and listeners, I'll sometimes say we have, because I also include my wife in this. It's her battle as well. She doesn't have the physical symptoms, but everything else she certainly shares with me, the emotional side, the mental side of this, and she certainly shares it, and she's at every major appointment, so I often say we.
Right.
When I say it, but and so I have, or we have, another tumor in my abdomen, and so let me talk about the tumor in my abdomen for a second. Is that required radiation treatment in December, and so in January when we had a scan, about a month after the radiation treatments, the scan revealed that tumor in the abdomen had shrunk by potentially a centimeter. And Mo, I'll say this. I learn all this stuff as I go.
Right.
I had no idea about any of this stuff. And so I was no cancer expert, and why would anyone be unless they've had to deal with it, really up front, close, and personal. And so the indication from that is because it's shrinking, that my doctors believe that tumor is dying or is dead. When tumors start to shrink, that means the cancer cells are dying or have died, and the space where the tumor is starts to shrink a little bit. It may not disappear, that mass may not disappear completely, because the cancer cells turn into scar tissue when they die.
Gotcha.
So there's a mass. So really, when doctors look at it, a tumor, their biggest thing is making sure that it doesn't grow. They're not so concerned as much, like, they don't need to see it shrink. If it shrinks, great. And if it disappears, all the better. But with the one that was in my abdomen, the one on my liver, they're substantial sizes. The one on my liver is about 6 centimeters by 6 centimeters. And Mo, I don't remember when you were in grade school. When I was, I thought that our teacher said that we were going to learn the metric system, because the United States would be converting to the metric system, the way the rest of the world operates. That never happened, obviously.
Right.
But my doctors, when I go to do my, a check-in for a treatment, I measured in kilograms my weight.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about the size of my lesions or tumors in centimeters. So I've had to, reassociate myself with the metric system. a little bit, but that's a substantial size as well. And so as long as cancer isn't growing, And I'll talk about lots of things, but that was one thing. I'm 48, and so I grew up when cancer spreads from the colon to the liver, not once but twice. It was viewed as a fatal disease sooner or later. And the way cancer treatment is today, the advances they've made in even 20 years, that they can treat some cancers, not all, but some you can treat it like a chronic illness. And I know this is a loose comparison, but say as the way they would treat diabetes or someone who has heart problems. It is a chronic problem. You need to take medicine for it,
right.
But we can control it and manage it so that you can live and potentially live much longer than previous lifespans were for people who had colon cancer that metastasized to the liver a couple of times. And so I give you a little update on where the tumor in the abdomen was, and that's a little easier to address.
Right.
The tumor on the liver is a little bit more difficult, Bo, and I could give readers, our listeners, a quick backstory is that when we found out it spread to my liver in fall of 2016, I had liver surgery to remove the two lesions that were on my liver. And my doctors characterized it, just so people could get a little idea visually, because this is, I ask questions and I get answers here,
right.
Is they took about two small ice cream scoop chunks of liver out. And so to that end, it left me, the liver's an amazing organ. It has the ability to regenerate, grow back a little bit, and everything. But obviously you have a serious situation
right.
on your hand. That was 2016. I started chemotherapy in November of 2016, shortly after surgery. And ultimately what happened is chemotherapy was debilitating for me. It caused a couple health issues that were potentially deadly. I'll just be honest about that. I had a pulmonary embolism, similar to, we want to talk about it NBA-wise, Chris Bosh.
Right.
Had it, and it's a blood clot that travels to the lungs. And, that's a scary situation. Where's a Teletovich? Also dealing with it, with the, formerly of the Milwaukee Bucks, but when he was with the Brooklyn Nets, he was also diagnosed with it. And then chemotherapy gave me a heart condition, which potentially could have caused a heart attack. And then finally, above all, chemotherapy just didn't work for me, because in spring of 2017, it was revealed that, cancer had returned to the liver and to the abdomen. And so chemotherapy just didn't work for me, Bo. That's the bottom line. And that's frustrating. It's scary. You look at chemotherapy as like, hey, this is the trusted and true line, first line of defense. But this is what most important to my situation is I'm on some progressive treatments right now. It's called immunotherapy. And it's a drug that essentially, for lack of medical terms here, teaches your immune system to fight cancer. And just to follow up on that is, in general, most people's, when they have cancer, their cancer cells are invisible to the immune system, which fights disease in general. Your immune system does a wonderful job. When you're not feeling well, it helps repair
right.
what's going on. But cancer cells are invisible. What this immunotherapy drug does is it unmasks the cancer cells and makes them visible to my immune system. And then the immune system also goes into overdrive on this drug. It goes out to attack the cancer and the cancer cells. And so what we're seeing, Mo, my last scan was in January. I have one coming up in a week, and that's always, look, I can have some levity and humor in the situation. I call it scansiety.
Right.
I get a scan every 3 months. For 2.5 months, I live my life fairly normally. But those 2 weeks before the scan, I get really anxious, nervous. You don't
right.
know what the scan is going to reveal. The one thing I remember someone tell me early on, a doctor, cancer's unpredictable. You can see results one way, you can see results another way. It is often, the proverbial 2 steps forward, maybe 3 steps back. You go sideways, you go up and down. There's all kinds of things. You just can't predict what cancer will do. But in my scan in January, this is some good news here, is the immunotherapy shows that it's working on the tumor on the liver. and that tumor also decreased in size by a small amount. And so that's sort of where we are. You know, I brought you up to speed. There's lots of things, you know, I could keep talking about. The immunotherapy, you know, people, it doesn't work on every cancer situation. It happens that I have a genetic cancer, or my cancer was fueled by a genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. And so what gave me the cancer, you know, I call this whole situation, there's tons of paradoxes involved, but one of them is the very thing that, you know, gave me the cancer is also the very reason that allows the immunotherapy drugs to work. And I can get more technical and everything, but I have a specific cancer there's lots of mutations of the cancer cell where more common cancers have smaller mutations, so it makes it difficult for the immune system. This is how I look at it. I've broken it down. So when you have just a few mutations of the cancer in the cancer cell, for your immune system, it's like finding the proverbial needle in a haystack. My particular genetic cancer produces cancer and cancer cells by mutations in the hundreds. And so it's like shooting fish in a barrel for my immune system.
Right.
And makes it easier to discover. So those are a couple things that are going on, Bo. I know I'm long-winded about it. I can offer, you know, a general PSA as well for listeners, you know, the deeper we get into this.
Yeah. I think the first thing I'm really happy to hear about is how the scan went in January. That's good news, and we're on the right track. And I know you're getting ready for your next scan, and hopefully we're going to be even better and in a better situation. What is the PSA? Like, what should listeners look out for?
So I'll tell you a couple, Bo, when you ask about the next scan, this is the one thing that's encouraging. And I don't like to get caught up too much in this because, as I said, it's unpredictable. A doctor can promise you nothing.
Right.
You know, there's not a promise here or a guarantee. But the encouraging thing about the immunotherapy is this, is that once they see it begin to work, and there's the qualification of the word seem, but the doctors say it seems to continue to work. And so that's what we're really excited about. The scan coming up, we'll get some, you know, I think my doctors, without promising me anything, I think they would be surprised if we had a setback. I go into this knowing very well that there could be
right.
a setback. So here's the next thing about it, well, for a PSA, is when I was diagnosed, I was just 45. It was pre-colonoscopy age. They suggest when you're 50 years old, I did not know about the genetic disorder, which left me with an incredibly high percentage of getting cancer. I did not know about it. It was a gene that was, you know, passed down to my mom. My mom never had cancer, so she did not, you know, she was not familiar, you know, with it
right.
and everything. So what happened with me, and this is a couple things. I'll say this. If there is a history of cancer in your family, you know, just simply let your doctor know. That could be the first step, because I will say this, when it comes to colon cancer, well, it's one of the preventable cancers in this way, is that polyps turn into tumors. And when a doctor does a colonoscopy, they remove polyps as they see them so that it doesn't turn into a tumor, a cancerous tumor. So that's number one. You know, get when you're 50, look, everyone belly aches about doing a colonoscopy.
Right.
The thing that makes me most happy is when I hear people and they go and do it. And ultimately, is it a, you know, the prep work, is it uncomfortable? Yes, but we're all adults here. You know, there's lots of things that are uncomfortable, but let's think of our health and living a, you know, a much longer life as opposed to being, you know, discouraged about doing a colonoscopy. It's one day you move out with it, it's over and done, and it's completely fine. I'll say that much. The second thing is, listen to your body. You know, that's what really drove me. Mm-hmm. But I'll say this, when my diagnosis came, it was just considered barely stage 2 colon cancer. You know, unfortunately, it was a low chance of a recurrence, and yet it recurred. And everything. My lymph nodes were clean. They tested 29 of them on the colon surgery when I still had a recurrence, but I had to listen to my body. And during the 2015 playoffs, I noticed little things. Taking the stairs left me winded. Getting on the elliptical, and I think everyone knows this, Mo, you get on the elliptical,
right.
you can, most people can blindfold them, sleepwalk through 15, 20 minutes on the elliptical. 5 minutes in, I was like gassed, and I was like, man, I can't believe this. I also had some painful cramps in my calves as well, made it difficult to sleep. And so I get home from the final, and also at one time, well, this is really the only gastro issue. You know, one time I had some bad stomach cramping. It was between games 1 and 2 of the finals that first year between Golden State and Cleveland. And I just chalked it up. Well, you've seen this.
Right.
You're on the road for constantly 2 months during a playoff stretch. You're exhausted. You're beat up. You're taking flights nonstop. Of course you're tired and don't feel well.
Right.
You know, but that's the easy way to justify all this. But I got back after the draft that year, and my wife said, you know what? If all these things are that abnormal to you and that bothersome, it's, you know, you're worried, go see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately what I did. So that's the PSA, Mo. If, you know, if there's a family history, let your doctor know. If you're of colonoscopy age, 50, although there, you know, if you have a family history, doctors may recommend doing it before 50. Get them done. You know, here's the other thing, Mo. If you're 50 years old and you get a colonoscopy and it's clean, they tell you to come back in 10 years. So it's not like you have to do it yearly. Now, if they remove some polyps, they may say come back in 5 years.
Right.
And if they find out there's a genetic issue, you know, which if a family member of mine has the same genetic issue, then they go get a colonoscopy every year, Mo, and a doctor can find out and remove polyps before they turn to tumors. And, you know, the third part of it is listen to your body. If something's not right, go see a doctor. And I know this, we hear it all the time, but it's just not men, women too. We know we all avoid the doctor.
Right.
Because we don't want to know. But I will say this. In my situation, knowing has probably saved my life to the point we are right now, as opposed to ignoring symptoms, putting it off, and instead of stage 2 cancer, it could have been stage 4 that had spread beyond anything the doctors could do in everything. And, you know, I had early detection, and because I'm on a regimen of getting scans all the time, we can still catch the next, if something arises, we can still catch it in its early stages and make plans. So, Mo, I have a great attitude. It's sometimes scary and frightening. I call it the rabbit hole of darkness and sadness. I get myself in it. I don't like it.
Right.
I get myself out of it eventually in everything. But by and large, I feel comfortable because I have the support and love of family and friends, and I have great care.
Right.
And so those things keep me moving day by day.
Yeah, no, first off, I really appreciate you spending the time kind of breaking it down for everybody. I know it's a basketball podcast, and we're going to get to that, but this is really important stuff. And meeting you in February and kind of, you know, you were very open about it and talking to me about it. So I just, you know, I was like, I can't have you on the podcast and not, we got to talk about it and we got to get it out there. And it's really important for anybody out there. Take Jeff's advice. He's going through it. He's going through it with a very positive attitude. Great guy. And you got all the support from me. Anything I can do to help you out, you just let me know.
No, I appreciate it, Mo. And that's the thing too. Not everyone, but people say that. And even if people don't do anything, they know that I have people in my corner. Because it's not easy. I can sit here like I'm talking about it very freely, but it's not always easy. But to know that, you know, people care, and, you know, there's another paradox, Mo, and I'll wrap it up with this, is that, you know, I would trade my situation in a heartbeat for not to have it, okay? But also, when I talk about that support and love I feel from everyone, I don't know what I would trade that for either. Like, that's been pretty amazing as well. I know we can get flustered in this world with people, but, you know, when the rubber meets the road and you need people, well, I've found that people are there. And, You know, I'm just thankful that in my life I've been able to meet those kinds of people.
Yeah, no. And you're a great guy. So I you're one of those people. So I'm very happy you have more of them around you. But let's get to basketball now.
Yeah. And Bernie, I'm sorry. Well, let me say this. Basketball and doing this job has also kept me sane too. You know, people would say, man, how can you work with all this going on? I will say this is, it's been a salvation, if you will, to be able to continue working, do my job, talk to people like you, go cover games, write and talk about the NBA. I mean, it helps keep my mind in the right place. So let's get to some hoops.
Right. Perfect. And let's start with, obviously, the biggest game last night was the Cavs-Raptors game. You know, the Cavs have been 9-1, you know, the last 10 games. They beat the Raptors twice. You know, are they rounding into playoff form? Like, from when you're seeing them, are you looking at them and going, like, man, okay, they look like they're beginning to get it?
I do, Mo, for this couple of reasons, is that they're starting to get healthy. That's number one. And even beyond health, they've never really had a full lineup
right. All
year. You know, they were always waiting on something, waiting on Isaiah Thomas to come back. That doesn't work out. Then Kevin Love gets injured and misses, you know, 20-plus games. And then they make this, revamp their roster at the trade deadline, ship in, what, I don't know if it was 5-6 guys out, bring in 4 guys in.
Right.
And then not all those guys have been healthy. Although Rodney Hood's been out. Larry Nance has been out. Now even George Hill is out. But they're starting to get healthy. And then I always say this. You talk about rounding into playoff shape or form. Is you see LeBron James, since that trade, has been, he's been fantastic, though. That's just the bottom line. It's about nearly a triple-double since the beginning of February. That he's averaging, that's over the course of 25, 26 games. He's, you know, carrying this team, and we've seen it before and everything. I'd love to hear you on this. I don't know if this is the worst team he's had going into a playoffs since he started this run with the Miami Heat 2010-11 season. But it's certainly been one of the most unstable rosters he's had. And he's just carrying them in. My one concern is the concern I always have with this team. I think it can get them through the Eastern Conference is they're just not very good defensively.
Right.
You mentioned the 10 games, Mo, they're 9-1. I'm just looking at their defensive rating. It's still pretty bad. They're still giving up points. I mean, it's 108.3 points per 100 possessions they're giving up. That's barely in the top 20. But what they can do is what they always do in the Eastern Conference playoffs. They could just outscore you and not worry about the defensive end. So in this 10 games, I'm looking at it, they're at 114 points scored for 100 possessions. And that's tops in the league right now. And so they're putting it together offensively. And, again, I think that's the kind of thing that can carry them through the Eastern Conference playoffs into the finals. Now when they get to the finals, that defense gets exposed a little bit more.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's the thing about it. You know, defensively, obviously, I'm worried. I just think, gosh, they are gelling on the offensive end. Love looks really good out there. He's been playing well, helping to spread the floor. It actually makes Larry Nance's job easier when he rolls to the rim as well. You know, they got Tristan Thompson back. I mean, they've not been healthy, and they still, I mean, with Hill out now, they still, I don't feel like, have had the whole team healthy for at least one game, even in this stretch, just because Hill just went out. So,
and Mo, I wanted to, if you don't mind me throwing a question your way, I wanted to, since you break this stuff down exceptionally well. So you mentioned Love, you mentioned spreading the floor. You know, what are they doing offensively? Like, what's their MO? Is it pretty free form? What kind of set plays in particular are they running? I know they like to get Korver, you know, some open threes. He's even been out a little bit, both the injury and the death of his brother. But what are they doing offensively to make it work?
Well, you know, one thing, they have a very common, like, elbow set action where they usually enter the ball into LeBron, you know, at like the elbow, you know, high post area. And for those who aren't know what I'm talking about with the elbow, it's where the free throw the free throw line and the lane line meet, it kind of creates a 90 degree, like a corner, and we just call that the elbow. And they run kind of, it's very similar to like what Sacramento used to run with Vlade, Weber, and Bibby. You know, a lot of action there where LeBron will catch it on the elbow. There'll be a screen in the strong side corner, and it's usually like, you know, Love kind of coming off for, you know, to the cut into the rim, and if it's a good screen, he gets a layup there. If not, LeBron kind of can go into a dribble handoff action with whatever guard was setting the screen. On the weak side, they have a pin down. Now they're doing stuff where, you know, they'll run that set, and it won't be LeBron getting the ball at the elbow, but he's going to post up on the weak side, which makes it really difficult to send help and things like that. I mean, they just do a good job of really kind of spreading the floor. I think that's kind of a set I see on a regular basis from them. I expect to, I would scout, and you know, if I was a preparing against them, I would have a bunch of clips of that, you know, the different iterations of that action that they have at the elbow. And then it's a lot of it is free form, you know, high pick and roll with LeBron, and let's let LeBron, you know, create a lot of pin downs for Korver. Like you said, you got a weapon like Korver, you got to use him, you know, and you got to get him, you know, a couple of threes, you know, early, and you got to keep him fed often just to kind of keep that rhythm going, because it's really a dangerous weapon. Because you and I both know their defense isn't really going to win them games. It's going to be their offense in the playoffs. So that's something they got to kind of constantly keep doing and keep rolling. And I just think, you know, when I watch them, I just look at them going like, they've kind of figured it out on offense. Like, that was the big concern. Could, with such a big trade and all these pieces kind of coming in, it looks like they've finally figured it out on offense. It's hard on defense because if you got to know rotations and things like that, it's harder to get that going quickly. Offense, you can, and they got it now. So I'm not worried about them scoring points, you know, and I think they'll be able to score enough against pretty much almost every Eastern Conference team.
I'm with you on that, Mo. Like, I've so wanted all year to pick Toronto as the team I think is going to get to the finals. They've been so good for so long this season, and, you know, the last two games against the Cavs, now both in Cleveland and everything, and let's not forget that the Raptors put a whooping on the Cavs back in January. I mean, that was a 30-point victory. It was over by halftime. I don't even know if LeBron and the starters played, but that was also, you know, that team was – I look at that month of January for Cleveland. Isaiah's coming back that month. They're in disarray. Isaiah's not working out. It was LeBron's worst month of the year, Cleveland's worst month of the year. I don't want to necessarily say throw it out in disregard everything, but I've so, you know, getting back that, I so enjoyed playing Toronto, or seeing Toronto play this year. And then just real quick on Cleveland, Mo, you have one guy in LeBron who, you know, we've talked about it more last year about this ability for Cleveland or any LeBron team to turn it on or off. I know coaches don't like that, the idea that we can just turn it on. But I would say this, if there's anyone who understands the long haul of playing 20-plus games in the playoffs and another 2 months of the season and understanding what's required to do that, it's LeBron. And whether he's pacing himself, and you look at his numbers, you're like, geez, how is that guy pacing himself? You know, what more can he give? But he certainly understands what's needed to win in the playoffs, and better than any other player in the league right now. And so sometimes I just wonder if, you know, we're hypercritical of the Cavs, not fully understanding that LeBron has this all planned out and understanding that they can start playing the way they want to in April, get through the first round, and be a much better team by the time they get to the conference semis.
Yeah, and I always find it funny when we doubt the Cavs. They've gone three straight times to the finals with LeBron. LeBron's been to, I believe it's seven. This might be eight if they make it this year.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, for any of us to be like, oh, well, no, they can't. I'm like, listen, LeBron knows what he's doing. Like, you kind of just have to trust him with that. You have to trust Ty Lue. You have to trust the Cavs all together. And not just LeBron. I mean, this is Love's, you know, he's been through it, you know, three times now, going on four. And things like that. The one other guy I want to just kind of highlight, and it's kind of funny to me, Jose Calderon. Everybody ridiculed the Cavs for picking up Jose Calderon. But man,
I'm glad you hit on this topic, bro. I'm so glad.
It's just funny to me because, like, every time I watch, I'm just like, He's almost their most consistent player, and he doesn't play every game. You know, when guys are healthy and thinks he's in and out of the lineup, he comes in and he contributes almost every time. I know he hurts defensively, and there are issues there, but I'm just like, every time I watch him, I go like, you know what? He's a guy that you got to have on your team. He eats minutes and he's helpful. He doesn't really kill you that much.
He's a wonderful person too, Mo. If you've ever had a chance to spend a couple minutes with Jose, he's just a really friendly guy. And you know what? I'm just quickly looking. Look, he gives up defensively. They know that. But every time I see him in the starting lineup, in fact, when I made mention of this as early as December, when the Cavs went on that early run in December, I don't know if what was it, they won 13 in a row. Jose Calderon was the starting point guard.
Right.
Of that, the whole run. He was fantastic against the Raptors last night. You're not going to get that kind of offense or that kind of scoring from him, but he's reliable enough from the three-point line that you can't let him have it. He makes the right play, and I would go, you know, I haven't looked at every five-man lineup, but I would say a majority of the Cavs, without, you know, looking at it, a majority of their positive lineups in net rating with, you know, a specific amount of, or at least a specific amount of number, a minutes played, I bet you Jose Calderon is almost on all of them.
It wouldn't shock me. I mean, the guy knows how to play. I mean, just forget about it. I mean, his NBA career, he's been a journeyman in the NBA. He's was great in Spain, you know, playing in Europe as well as playing for the Spanish national team. Like, he knows how to play, and it's just, so it's not a surprise to me, but it's just funny because it's sometimes just unexpected considering how much grief the Cavs got for signing Calderon and then him ending up having to start. Like you said, that he was part of that 13-game winning streak. You just can't deny that stuff.
You know, Kobe Altman, the general manager there, he's done some things he probably deserves a little bit of criticism for, but he's probably done a lot of things that he deserves credit for. You know, it was a bold move to revamp that. I mean, to cut ties with Isaiah Thomas at the time. I mean, I know something had to be done, but, you know, he came away looking really good. But then just going back to that simple signing of Jose Calderon, you know, the Cavs would be in a world of hurt you know, if they have not had him, and I'm not sure anyone would have said that at any point leading up to this season, that the Cavs needed Jose Calderon to be where they are right now.
Yeah, and let's kind of switch from the Cavs, and let's talk about their opponent last night, Toronto. I mean, Toronto's had losses. You know, they had an 11-game win streak, which they looked great. Everybody was ready to say, this is it. They're going to take the Cavs in the playoffs. They have a legitimate chance to the NBA Finals. They still do. But since that streak ended, they've lost to the Cavs twice, Oklahoma City, who ended that streak. They lost to Boston and to the Clippers. It's worrisome. You know, Kyle Lowry goes 2-for-11, I think, last night with only 5 points. It's becoming a worrisome trend where it's almost, you know, there's a joke going around going like, are they rounding into their playoff form? Or is this like, what, you know, how worried are you about them?
Yeah, I'm trying not to panic about the Raptors.
Right.
But I'm hoping the Raptors aren't panicking either. You know, so here's a couple things. And I said earlier that, like, I've long said that, you know, I've wanted to pick the Raptors to get to the finals. And so they've had the best record in the East for a long stretch of the season. But now even that is starting to be, you know, look a little dicey. As it stands right now, although they got lucky last night, I think, with Milwaukee's victory
against Boston. Yeah, that was big.
Which was big for them. And I think the thing, in, you know, I'm really impressed with what they've done offensively this year. I give Dwayne Casey a ton of credit. I mean, I don't know where I'm going to put him in my Coach of the Year voting, but he's going to be up there. He revamped that offense, and, you know, they're not so reliant DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry to do everything. And I'll say this, well, how many people at the beginning of the year, I talk about the beginning of the year, thought Pascal Siakam would be a vital player for the Raptors? That bench mob unit that they have has been fantastic. I think Dwayne and the player development coaches and assistant coaches there get a ton of credit for making, you know, Fred VanVleet, DeLon Wright, Norman Powell, Jakob Poeltl. I mean, all those guys contribute, and that's a credit to them. My concern right now with them is defensively.
Yeah.
And they've been such a good team all season long. For a long time, Mo, they were right there with Golden State as one of the only two teams who were top five in offense and defensive efficiency. Those numbers usually bode well for a team when it comes to the playoffs. It's not a guarantee that you're going to get anywhere, but, you know, it shows that you can score, you can defend, and those are the two things, you know, ultimately when you get into some of these playoff games, you know, you have to do both exceptionally well to keep advancing. So my concerns defensively with that team, and, you know, just looking at the numbers, those past 10 games, they've been scoring, but they've also been giving up a ton of points, and that's what worries me.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I literally just pulled up the net ratings for the last 10 games. Offensive rating, 112.3 for the Raptors. Defensive rating, 112.0. So basically just a, you know, plus three in that rating. And you know, their defensive rating is 28th right now in the NBA in the last 10 games. That's a massive problem. As much as we want to talk about the Cavs are at least in the top 20. These guys in their last 10 games defensive rating. These guys have dropped all the way down to, you know, they're the third worst. Like, this is a big issue for them that they're going to have to figure out. And I knew they're good. I still think they're very good. I am very skeptical because my issues were always, what did they do in the playoffs? They seem to not be able to pull it together in the playoffs, so I have to see them in the playoffs. And, man, it doesn't matter who they play. If they lose that first game in the playoffs, that's going to be incredibly tough. Just everybody's going to just start jumping ship.
And here's what I don't want to, you know, I don't want to see the Raptors panic either if they did lose that first game. So many times I felt in the playoffs that they've been reactionary to things. Like, you know, that they have some, you know, that they see Cleveland go to a small ball lineup. So, and all of a sudden, you know, Dwayne Casey pulls Jonas Valanciunas when Valanciunas has been playing well. Now, I know sometimes it's about matchups, but we've seen it, and Dwayne has said he wants to keep it. You know, I also don't want to see a scenario where he doesn't start playing those bench guys as much either. And they revert back to maybe the way they played in the past. I mean, the whole idea of changing the way they played is because they realized it hasn't worked in the playoffs.
Right.
They can't beat Cleveland that way. And, you know, when they lost to him last year in a sweep, in a six-game series the year before that. And so they made these changes based on playing against Cleveland. So, you know, I just hope that they, you know, if they, you know, whenever they lose a playoff game, it doesn't, you know, jumpstart some kind of movement to go back to the way they used to play, because they've learned that that doesn't work. So I'm really going to be watching Toronto and how they manage those lineups.
Yeah, and that's a tough situation. And I think as a coach, you kind of, you get worried. You know, we always know the playoff rotation shortened. You know, it's shorter than your regular rotation and whatnot, but they have such a deep bench. I know Casey doesn't really want to shorten that. It's just going to be a difficult issue for them. I'm not sure. And again, it's I really think it's going to come down to Kyle Lowry. Like, he's got to get himself going again.
Yeah.
He's a superstar player, and he's got to start playing a superstar level. Like, he can't have many more 2-11 performances. Like, they're not getting very far if that's the case.
Yeah, Mo, and that's the thing. They've been able to, you know, they need him at these moments because I think by and large, you look at Kyle's numbers this year. The Raptors, I think, are going to set a franchise record for victories in a season, and this has not been Kyle's best numbers or best season statistically. And so they've been able to do some things without him having great numbers.
Right.
But what they do need from him is good numbers. And, you know, that's the point, you know, that you're getting to is that, you know, you need that guy to put up some kind of, it doesn't need to be, you know, 20-10 kind of numbers, but you need him involved in producing offensively, which makes the rest of it work.
Right, because, yeah, it takes pressure off of DeRozan to, you know, feel like he has to make everything happen. It allows the young guys to kind of feel more comfortable, like, okay, we got DeMar and Kyle going, like, we're in good shape, you know. And at the end of the day, they're still depending on a lot of young guys. OG Anunoby's a rookie, you know. Van Vliet, these guys are all still pretty young. Pascal Siakam, they have playoff experience, but not a lot. and not a lot where they've seen major minutes. So it's a different leap for them. So it's almost like a new playoff experience for those guys.
I agree with that, Mo. And I'm old school in this. I look at, years go back to the 80s when, whether it was the Pistons taking time to finally beat the Celtics and then finally beat the Lakers in the finals, or when the Chicago Bulls couldn't get past the Pistons during Jordan's, right before his championship runs. Then they finally beat the Pistons. I mean, it takes some experience to get to those situations. And, as you mentioned, some of the teams that the Cavs may face, even if it's Toronto or Philadelphia or even the Boston team, who's going to have to play a lot of young guys, they do not have that experience when it's a two-point game with 3 minutes to go and the screws get real tight. That's where LeBron – is masterful in that situation against teams like that.
Yeah, and that's the whole ball game there.
Yep.
One thing I do want to talk about, and it is my favorite subject, because I have a bit of a sweet tooth, is I'm a big gelato fan. I don't know if you know this about me, Jeff. I wish I took you to it when you're out here in LA for the All-Star break. That's a fail on my end. But my favorite thing is there's my favorite gelato place, and I think it's the best gelato in all of the land, definitely in all of L.A. It's Uli's Gelateria in downtown on Spring Street in between 5th and 6th Street, and they have a second location in the Beverly Grove area, 3rd Street and Crescent Heights, which I still haven't made my way out there, but I'm coming, guys, so get my Speculoos cookies out and ready to go because that's my favorite flavor. But they do a bunch of seasonal flavors. I think they recently did a blood orange flavor, which I missed out on. It might still be available now, but I got to go check that out. But a bunch of beautiful flavors, great people. You really can't go wrong. Uli's Gelateria, I highly recommend it, whether you're in downtown or the Beverly Grove area, or just make a trip out. It's worth it. Just make the trip out and get yourself some Uli's Gelateria. Jeff.
Mo, just real quick, Mo, hey, you and I have had a couple food discussions, especially some places I went to in L.A. that you co-signed on. And so if you're recommending a gelato joint, I know some of the places you like to eat, so I'm going to co-sign on the gelato joint. And next time I'm out in L.A., we're definitely hitting that spot.
Done, definitely. One thing I do want to talk about, let's get back on track a little bit, although it's 8:50 and now I want gelato, so that's a bit weird. Is there a team in the East that you feel is a sleeper that you're like, I'm going to really keep my eye on? I mean, everybody's talking about Philly. There's Washington getting John Wall back, Giannis in Milwaukee, Miami. Is there a team you're kind of keeping an eye on in the playoffs?
This way, is it fair for us to pick Philadelphia as the sleeper team? And I'll say it this way: I do think they're the team no one wants to face in the Eastern Conference playoffs. I will put it that way. I think they've been and Mo, you may have the numbers there too. They may be one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference they have been one of the best. I don't know if they've been the best. They've been one of the best teams in the East when you look at efficiency ratings since January 1. They've been really, really good. Now, that all coincides with Embiid being on the court for a majority of those games. So I know that's important as well. And right now he's recovering from the facial fracture. So anything that happens with the Sixers is going to depend on Embiid. And so that's going to, I do think they're dangerous. I like the way they play. Excuse me. Washington is another interesting team. If they're the seventh seed right now, and that's, I think that's where they are after last night's games.
Yeah,
I don't know if they'll finish there because teams 6, 7, and 8 are so close. We may get a tiebreaker ruling on those seeds right there. But they get John Wall back, and he is back. And they're playing decent basketball. I mean, don't forget, this is a team that took the Celtics to 7 games last year in the playoffs. And so they could be – the thing that has killed them, and I saw – they've just been inconsistent. And there was – it's probably not funny to Scott Brooks and general manager Ernie Grunfeld.
Right.
But the Washington Post did a story yesterday on all the times Bradley Beal and Scott Brooks have said the Wizards' play is unacceptable.
Oh, no.
And there was a lot of times you go through the quotes that those two guys have said that their play is unacceptable. And you know, so whether it's doing it for 48 minutes, and I know that's real difficult,
right?
But that's what it takes. And you, I know Brad's had to carry the load a lot with John out. Don't forget, John has missed about half the season.
Yeah, he's missed a ton of time
this year. And so it's not like he's been there the whole time. But I will say this, and I don't know how bad he was playing with that injury. I think we saw Zach Lowe write a story earlier this year. I hope I'm giving credit to the right guy, that, you know, John Wall was one of the most stationary guys in the league.
Yeah.
And so I have to believe that, because we don't think of John Wall as a stationary guy at all. From baseline to baseline, he's one of the quickest guys in the league. He gets the ball and go. And so you have to believe that injury was hampering him. But the Wizards have pretty much identical winning percentage with John Wall and without John Wall. I think they're a little bit better percentage-wise with John than without. But the point being is that even with John, you know, that they've been just, you know, that, you know, percentage, winning percentage of about 55, 56. And, you know, maybe that just indicates who they are. Those inconsistency issues have plagued them all year. I will say this, though. They've long been regarded as a team that either plays up or down to their competition.
Right.
And so if they're going to get a team like Boston in the first round, and, you know, although there is a little bit of bad blood, I think now that the Morris brothers, the Morai brothers, are on those teams, Boston, Washington, it's eased a little bit of the blood battle there.
Right.
And everything. But that's a series where I could see Washington, you know, I would never pick Washington to win it, but could really give Boston some trouble if that's what it was.
Well, it's funny you brought that up. I had recently written about Wall and the Wizards, because there was a whole lot of talk of, are the Wizards better without John Wall? Because, and again, same, almost very similar winning percentage, similar stuff. You know, and the way I looked at it was, when John Wall is with the team, when he was playing, he basically missed two chunks of the season, which turned out, I don't remember the number of games exactly, but looking at the stats, when he played in the first part before he had injuries, they averaged 273 passes a game, which was good for 28th in the NBA. When he was out, they averaged 309. When he came back, 277, which was 25th. When he was out again, 314, and they really kind of went on a run during that stretch. That was 6th in the NBA. For me, with John Wall and the Wizards, it's, if he can come back and continue this ball movement thing that they have going right now, I think that takes them to the next level. I think that makes them a really good team, and takes him to another level. Like, I equated it to Tony Parker, who oftentimes in San Antonio would get off the ball and make the first pass, run around and all over the court, and then catch it, you know, towards late in the clock, and then make a play. I feel like sometimes Wall just dominates the ball too much, in the same way that we were used to Chris Paul dominating the ball with the Clippers last year. Just kind of, he has great numbers. He's a great player that still creates for others, but ball was in his hands for like 15 seconds. I had a great clip where there was no passes for 15 seconds. It was him holding the ball the entire possession and then shoots a mid-range jumper. That's not really wasn't really a great shot, and he never put any pressure on defense. That's what it is for me with the Wizards. If he comes back and he did it in the first game he came back, they moved the ball. I looked, checked the tracking numbers. They had 300 something passes, and they won in his game. You know, they came back. He missed the next one. They got blown out by Houston last night. But if he can move the ball and they can continue this ball movement and it maximizes all the other guys, I think they're really going to be a tough team. And I think they could probably beat Boston in the series. Like I would bet on Washington to upset Boston if they match up in the first round with all the injuries Boston has, and if Wall can keep that going. And then I want to go give you a number about Philly real quickly too, because in their last 10 games, their defensive rating is 95.8, I believe. Let me see. 95.1. It's the best in the NBA in the past 10 games. Embiid's missed two or three, so, you know, they're on an 11-game win streak. And the other thing too about the Embiid injury to me, it's kind of a blessing in disguise for them. because these guys have to learn how to win without Embiid on the court. This is huge for Simmons. Simmons has to learn how he can attack without Embiid in a game. And this is something that's really going to help them. You know, if you know they go into the first round and he doesn't play a game or two, at least they have a few wins in the bank of Ben Simmons kind of taking over. And granted, it's not the best competition, and playoff level is a whole other thing, and it'll be interesting to see how these young guys really react to being in the playoffs. But I think it's a good confidence builder for these guys, and I kind of think for Philly, this is it can line up perfectly for them if things match up, that they can actually get to the Eastern Conference Finals. But the other thing too for me is that scares me, because I don't know if they're ready for that, and on top of that, I don't know if they're ready for, if they make it to the Eastern Conference Finals, you and I both know it, the expectation train is going to ramp up and have them in the finals next year. And I'm not sure they're ready for that. It's just sometimes it might be a situation where they got lucky. And that's my concern for them. But those are the two teams I really am interested in the Eastern Conference come playoff time.
And you know, I'll add this just because I love what he does as a coach. I think we may have had this discussion All-Star weekend is, you know, I would never pick Miami, whatever seat they are. You know, now, I will say this. Miami-Cleveland would be intriguing.
Yeah.
Because of the LeBron situation, way back in Miami. And Cleveland has struggled at times with Miami. I think I looked it up the other night. Since LeBron went back, he hasn't played in every game at Miami, but the four games he's played in when the Cavs have been on the road, they've lost to the Heat. I thought that was pretty interesting. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. I was there at one Christmas Day game where the Heat won, but just recently, I think it was last week, the Heat won when the Cleveland Cavs came to town. That'd be interesting. But I mentioned Miami, well, only because I love the job Eric Spoelstra.
Yeah.
It's like he has his team ready to go. You know, I don't think they would win a round, but they are going to make it difficult for you to win a series. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, he puts you in that staff. You know, and Spo is one of the best in the NBA when it comes to coaches. I mean, we're really lucky right now in the NBA. We have a ton of great young coaches who have proven themselves to be really excellent coaches. Spo with his experience with the Big Three, you know, obviously Brad Stevens, Quinn Snyder. He's not that young, and I hope he doesn't hear this. Brett Brown, you know, has done a great job. You know,
yeah. When you talk about just head coaching experience, years head coach. I mean, I don't know, Mo. We talk about this, and this might not be part of the outline for the show, but I don't know what I'm going to do with my coach of the year votes.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, there are 6-7 guys. You know, that I could potentially give a vote to, and I was just looking at it. I think I could only give a first, second, and third place. I can't even give fourth or fifth on this. And the list is pretty long of guys who deserve some Coach of the Year recognition this season.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be the guy who wins Coach of the Year is going to have 5 votes. It's because it's just going to be spread out across so many guys. You know, it's going to be really kind of that close. But you did bring up the Heat, which also brings me to this nugget, and we can wrap it up from there. Hassan Whiteside had some interesting quotes 2 games ago about sitting during the crunch time. They ended up losing, I believe. I can't remember who they lost to. But they lose, and he comes in. And
it may have been Brooklyn. I think it was a bad
loss. It was Brooklyn, which I remember now because I was watching the game, which doesn't say a lot for me having.
But we watched so many games. The reason I pulled that one out, I remember specifically looking at what set him off.
Right.
Because I did not catch that game.
And it's and you know, I'm not going to go into his quotes, but he basically just said, I should be out there. It's an interesting situation because, you know, Kelly Olynyk, they play much better when he's on the court. Bam Adebayo, the kid from Kentucky, their rookie, he's been really good.
Really good, and
has picked it up of late. Like, he's just gotten better and better and better. It's kind of, you know, and they're not great when Hassan Whiteside's out there. And there's a big difference in, you know, just the quality of screen set when Kelly Olynyk sets a screen versus when Whiteside sets a screen. I know it was written about by somebody. I wish I could remember who wrote it and give him proper credit. But, you know, it was something I read earlier and went back and looked and said, yeah, he doesn't hit guys. He doesn't connect and things like that. My question to you is, you know, is he going to be wearing a different jersey next year? Like, I don't even know if there's a market out there for him.
So that was going to be I don't know either. I mean, at the 18-19 salary at $24.4 million and the 2019-20 salary at $27 million, I don't know exactly who's taking that on.
Right.
In this market right now. We're not going to see a big jump in the salary cap this year to next year. And I think we're going to get them soon, Mo. The salary cap numbers for 20, they'll give 28-19 with a little bit more specific numbers.
Right.
And they'll probably also, the league will also send out 2019-20. But I'm not expecting dramatic increases like we saw. And, you know, maybe a handful of $1 million increase from year to year. So I'm not sure what the market is going to be for him. That's a great point that you're making. But here's the other side of this, is that Heat organization really isn't a franchise that tolerates that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, Pat Riley runs a tight ship. Eric Spoelstra does too. I mean, you know, by and large, we've heard the stories that during the LeBron era, you know, that organization, you know, LeBron certainly had his people around, but they clamped down on some of it. That's for sure. And, you know, they just don't tolerate that. If you're on the Heat, you're in it for the team. There's not a lot of, they're happy for individual successes. There's no doubt about that. They want to see Goran Dragic on the All-Star team. You know, they want to see some recognition for Bam Adebayo as a all-rookie player. They
right.
certainly like to see that. But when it comes to players complaining about playing time, when they're trying to get into the playoffs, and get a better seed, I'm not sure that's exactly something that thrilled them. You saw a quick apology, too.
Yeah.
From a Whiteside on that. And maybe the message was delivered, and we'll see what happens. But unloading that contract, you know, may not be easy for the Heat if that's what they want to do. And I'll bring up something real quick. You mentioned Adebayo. There's another one, Mo. I think, you know, the rookies at the top of the class when it comes to Jason Tatum, Ben Simmons, and Donovan Mitchell.
Right.
And then there's a couple others, I think, who are having great years as well. But when it comes to that all-rookie team, you know, there are guys that, you know, I'm not going to know exactly where to put. And that includes a guy like Lonzo Ball, Bogdanovich from
Sacramento.
Right, yeah. Sacramento.
Yeah.
You know, you see a guy like even what Zach Collins is doing in Portland. A little bit. Some of these guys, John Collins as well in Atlanta.
Right.
Did I get that?
Yep.
One as well. And so some of these guys have not played lots of minutes because I think their teams are being very cautious on how they bring them along and distribute their minutes. But there's been some fantastic rookie performances beyond those guys who are in contention for Rookie of the Year that are fantastic. I know that, again, Bo, that wasn't on the program. But some of these guys, we're going to see some of these guys from this rookie class continue to be really talented players in the league. And it's going to show that we were probably right when we were looking at the 2017 draft class about being a really deep class.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just those guys. I mean, Kyle Kuzma has been great.
Yes.
You know, Dennis Smith Jr. has been up and down, but there's still highlights there that you can kind of see some stuff and you're excited for that. You know, it's been a
Lowry Markkanen is the other one from Chicago.
Yeah,
that's sort of been on my radar this season. We're really good players.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to pick the all rookie team. I mean, it's not all NBA difficult, but it's still going to be a little bit difficult because there's been enough guys that have done enough. I mean, Kyle Kuzma at the start of the season was unbelievable, and everybody was going nuts with it. He's kind of tapered off a little bit. He's not been as on fire as he was. But I'm really happy you brought up Bogdanovich and Sacramento because nobody really watches those games, so nobody's catching it that often. But he's been really good for them. So I'm with you. This rookie class has been excellent.
And I know it doesn't constitute as the traditional rookie, and I'm not talking about Ben Simmons either. But Milos Teodosic is considered a rookie. I know he's a,
yeah.
he is a veteran. I'm just pulling up the rookies. But well, I don't know off the top of my head. I don't remember where Dylan Brooks was picked by Memphis. I know he was a second rounder.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how deep he was, but they get minutes in production. He was the 45th pick. You know, they get production out of him as well. I mean, there's just, you know, some really, really good guys who have had some good minutes. And, you know, it's going to be tough to figure out. Some of these guys are learning to shoot the three. So you look at Josh Jackson's numbers, De'Aaron Fox. You know, shooting in the NBA is not easy. I'll say that. We look at guys' percentages, you know, compared to what they did in college. And, you know, for all this talk over the years that guys you know, that the NBA, there's no defense. I think that's been proven to be a misnomer and false, because you see these guys come in the league and they have trouble scoring.
Yeah, and shooting is so important, but it's a difficult thing. You know, I think it's something that takes time to develop, and we expect these guys to, okay, they'll have a new shot by next summer. You know, by next season, we're going to look at it and be like, he should be able to hit threes. I'm like, it's a progress, and gosh,
Well, I'd be remiss too. I'm still scrolling. I mean, how about in Toronto? I didn't even mention OG Anunoby,
right,
who has cracked the starting lineup there.
Yeah.
Josh Hart with the Lakers is proven to have some minutes. The other one too, I guess, that is a guy who I think is going to be really good, and his offense has surprised me, considering he was probably drafted as a pick and roll and rim protector. Jared Allen.
You just stole his name out of my mouth.
Yeah, how about that, Mo?
Yeah.
I mean, and talk about, I love, so you know how much I love the player development, coaches, and that side of the game. How about the work that, you know, I'm sure that Brooklyn staff and Kenny Atkinson, the coach of the Nets, is a player development guy through and through.
Right.
And look at the job that they've done with Jared Allen.
Yeah, I mean, you can't question. I mean, he's looking great, and I think we're the NBA is in such a great place with just how much talent we have right now. And, you know, it's going to be sad at some point. You know, I don't know when he can go for another 10 years maybe, but at some point LeBron's going to retire. At some point KD's going to be old, and Steph and all those guys. But we have all these young guys. Like when we talk about Anthony Davis, like, he's not even 25 yet. You know, Carl Anthony Towns, Embiid, Simmons, these.
Did Giannis just turn 23 this season?
Giannis, yeah. I mean, these dudes are still babies, you know, and they've been in the league for a while. So
I know, 5 years for Giannis. He's 23 years old. Amazing.
Yeah, so I just kind of like, I look at it going like, man, this is going to be a very interesting. I just think the NBA is in a great place, and I think this is a great place to end it here, Jeff. But why don't you plug your stuff, let the people know where they can find you, and I'll let you go, man. I've held on to you for too long.
No, Mo, enjoyed the conversation. Just love talking hoops, that's for sure, and digging in the weeds on some of this stuff. So, hey, if anyone wants to, you can go to Twitter. You can find me easily at Jeff Zilgit, Zillgitt. You can go to usatoday.com. And you'll find the NBA page there. You can find, and I'll promote Sam Amick, my colleague, as well. His content is there. And you can find the NBA A to Z podcast. I know you mentioned earlier, Mo, but that Sam and I do. You can find that on all your podcast listening stations, whichever, almost anyone you choose, you can find the podcast there. I don't need to mention all of them, but you can certainly find it where you like to download your podcast.
Perfect. And I listen. It's once or twice a week. I know I have so many basketball podcasts that just pop up on my phone. I listen. I enjoyed your brief appearance in yesterday's.
That was the briefest of the brief. That may have been my best appearance.
Sometimes it's better just to not say anything. I enjoy the podcast. I enjoy listening to you and Sam, and you guys get interesting guests and interesting interviews that I always find very, very helpful for me, just nuggets and stuff that I get to pick up on. So check out.
Yeah, Mo, I'm sorry to interrupt. Look, I love seeing your stuff online as well. I love the way you break down the game and pick out things. You know, we love, reporters love to watch the game, but we don't always watch it and see it with the same eye as people like you. see it. And so I always appreciate that insight.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'm going to leave on that note because that's the best compliment I'm going to get today. and I'm going to call it there. So, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, no problem. Well, we'll talk again soon.
That's it for our show. Quick thank you to Jeff. And also just a quick note, if you can, support cancer research. Let's beat the crap out of that disease and get rid of this. It's something we got to work together to because we all know somebody or ourselves have been affected by cancer. So good luck to Jeff, and let's send good wishes to him too.